the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for the month of September 2007. Please note that the full text of all articles may be viewed online at ajp.psychiatryonline.org, including all author affiliations and disclosures. This month will feature two articles from the STEP-BD study that present clinically important findings on the treatment of bipolar depression. Dave Miklowitz and colleagues discuss functional outcomes from intensive psychosocial intervention, and Joseph Goldberg and colleagues report on the effect of adding an antidepressant to the drug treatment of patients whose bipolar depression is accompanied by manic symptoms. We'll also highlight articles on two aspects of suicide. The first is Robert Gibbons and colleagues, who examined changes in SSRI prescription rates in recent years for children and adolescents. The second article is by Nadine Melham and colleagues, discussing familial and individual antecedents of suicidal behavior. In addition, James Leckman and Robert King present an editorial titled, A Developmental Perspective on the Controversy Surrounding the Use of SSRIs to Treat Pediatric Depression. From there, we'll turn to the relationship between depression and heart disease. Peter DeYonge and colleagues examine whether patients who do not respond to treatment for depression after myocardial infarction are more likely to have subsequent cardiac events. In a cross-sectional genetic association study, Christian Ott and colleagues tested whether a polymorphism in the serotonin transporter genes in patients with coronary disease is related to depression, perceived stress, and norepinephrine. We'll also highlight an editorial on these articles by Robert Carney and Kenneth Friedland. This month also brings us to the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. Megan Perrin and colleagues explore differences in PTSD prevalence and associated risk factors among World Trade Center disaster rescue and recovery workers. We'll conclude with two articles on the antipsychotic drug aripiprazole. Juchiho Shim and colleagues report on the use of aripiprazole to treat antipsychotic-induced hyperprolactinemia, and David Mamo and colleagues discuss its effects on D2, 5-HT2, and 5-HT1A receptors. Let's begin with the STEP-BD articles on treatments for bipolar depression. STEP-BD stands for Systematic Treatment Enhancement Program for Bipolar Disorder, which is supported by the National Institute of Mental Health. It is the largest treatment study ever conducted for bipolar disorder, and the data were collected in real-world clinical settings. The article by David Miklowitz and colleagues is titled, Intensive Psychosocial Intervention Enhances Functioning in Patients with Bipolar Depression, Results from a 9-month Randomized Controlled Trial. Randomized controlled trials have established the efficacy of combining drug treatment with manual-based, disorder-specific psychosocial treatments to prevent recurrences of bipolar illness over 1 to 2 years. However, few of these studies reported on functional outcomes. Previously, these authors reported that the 3 intensive psychosocial treatments in STEP-BD were superior to brief psychoeducation in hastening recovery from bipolar depression and increasing the number of months patients remained well during a 1-year period. This study compared how the same psychosocial treatments, in combination with pharmacotherapy, affected functioning following a bipolar depressive episode. The outcomes studied were the scores on the range of impaired functioning tool. These included the total score, as well as the scores for 4 specific domains, including relationships, satisfaction with activities, work or role functioning, and recreation. All of the patients were taking a mood stabilizer. They were randomly assigned to either 30 sessions of intensive psychosocial treatment or 3 sessions of psychoeducation. 3 types of intensive psychotherapy were used: interpersonal and social rhythm therapy, family-focused therapy, and cognitive behavior therapy. The intensive treatment extended over 9 months. The 84 patients who received intensive psychotherapy had higher scores for total functioning over the 9-month study than patients who received psychoeducation. Intensive treatment was also associated with greater improvements in 2 of the 4 specific functional domains. These domains included relationships and satisfaction with activities. Intensive treatment did not produce better results for work or role performance or for recreational activities. The authors point out that the scores for functioning were highly related to the concurrent level of depression, and that for most functional domains, the baseline score accounted for a significant proportion of the variance in outcome. This study was randomized, but Step BD also included naturalistic treatment. The article by Joseph Goldberg and colleagues analyzes results for bipolar patients participating in naturalistic treatment. The title is Adjunctive Antidepressant Use and Symptomatic Recovery Among Bipolar Depressed Patients with Concomitant Manic Symptoms, Finding from the Step BD. All of the patients had a full depressive episode plus 2 or more manic symptoms, and they were all receiving a mood stabilizing agent or an atypical antipsychotic. For 145 patients, an antidepressant had also been prescribed at the beginning of the study. These patients were compared with those who had not had an antidepressant prescribed. The proportions of patients taking specific mood stabilizing agents were similar for those who received adjunctive antidepressants and those who did not. The definition of recovery was the presence of 2 or fewer unequivocal affective symptoms for at least 8 weeks. Previous Step BD studies also used the intermediate clinical status of recovering, which was defined as having 2 or fewer symptoms for at least 4 weeks. The attainment of either of these states was the primary outcome point in this comparison. The results of a Cox regression model showed that the rates of patients considered recovered or recovering were similar in the patients taking antidepressants and those who were not. The only characteristic associated with the lower likelihood of recovery at 3 months was a greater depression severity at baseline. Another outcome examined did show a difference between treatment groups. A greater severity of manic symptoms was observed at 3 months among the patients receiving adjunctive antidepressants. Prior work has suggested that practitioners may fail to recognize manic symptoms during bipolar mixed states. If clinicians underappreciate manic or hypomanic symptoms and overattend to concomitant depressive symptoms, they may assume a beneficial role for antidepressant pharmacotherapy beyond the effects of mood stabilizing drugs. The Step BD findings suggest no advantage for such strategies. In fact, they raise the concern that manic symptoms may simply worsen with such treatment. The lack of benefit from adding an antidepressant to a mood stabilizer is also consistent with the results of prior randomized trials for pure bipolar depression. Now we'll turn to the articles on suicide. The first is by Robert Gibbons and colleagues and is titled Early Evidence on the Effects of Regulator Suicidality Warnings on SSRI Prescriptions and Suicide in Children and Adolescents. The authors noted that in October of 2004, the FDA ordered pharmaceutical companies to add a black box warning to the labeling of all antidepressants used with pediatric patients regarding a possible increased risk of suicidality in pediatric patients taking antidepressants. The authors therefore examined data on SSRI prescription rates in the U.S. in a time period surrounding this event, from 2002 to 2005, and stratified these rates by age. They observed that from 2002 to 2003, SSRI prescription rates had increased for all age groups. After 2003, prescription rates decreased for all age groups under the age of 60. They reported that from 2003 to 2005, the decrease in the 2 youngest age groups up to the age of 14 was approximately 20% overall and 30% for new prescriptions. The authors also reported that data from the CDC on suicide rates among children and adolescents during this time period were 2.8 per 100,000 in 2003, and this rate was increased to 3.2 per 100,000 in 2004. The second article related to suicide is Familial Pathways to Early Onset Suicidal Behavior, Familial and Individual Antecedents of Suicidal Behavior. Nadine Melham and colleagues identify several precursors of suicidal behavior in the offspring of parents with mood disorders. The offspring began the prospective study at an average age of 20 years. During the 6-year follow-up, suicide attempts or serious suicidal thoughts were more common among offspring with a mood disorder or impulsive aggression. The frequency was also higher among those with a parent who had attempted suicide, had been sexually abused, or depressed. James Leckman and Robert King comment on these two articles in an editorial titled, A Developmental Perspective on the Controversy Surrounding the Use of SSRIs to Treat Pediatric Depression. The editorial asks whether the decline in the use of SSRIs to treat children and adolescents is a positive change or one that will lead to increased numbers of suicides in this vulnerable population. Suicide rates were increased in both the United States and the Netherlands, and the Gibbons article offers predictions concerning the actual number of completed suicides should the number of prescriptions continue to decline. Unfortunately, it does not include an analysis of similar ecological data for both countries over the preceding decade, which presumably would have shown the reciprocal relationship, falling rates of suicide directly associated with the rising number of SSRI prescriptions. Nor does it address the conflicting results from a recent case control study that found in children and adolescents the risk of suicide attempts was 1.5 times higher after antidepressant treatment compared with no antidepressant treatment. For many children and adolescents with major depression and other mental disorders, treatment will involve the use of SSRIs. However, the comparison of benefit to risk varies as a function of age and indication. For example, in a recent meta-analysis of antidepressant treatment for nearly 6,000 children and adolescents, the study's authors were unable to detect a pooled risk difference in response greater than zero in children younger than 12 who were treated for major depressive disorder with SSRIs. In part, this lack of difference was due to a high rate of placebo response. Second, the choice of treatment should be the result of a collaborative discussion among the clinician, family, and patient. Data concerning age-specific benefits should contribute to this discussion, as well as the comparison of SSRIs with non-drug treatments. Third, there is a paucity of data concerning the long-term effects of these agents, and what data are available are a source of concern. For example, limited evidence suggests that the long-term use of antidepressants may be associated with the emergence of bipolar disorder, and that this risk appears to be greatest among the youngest group of children. It is also remarkable that there are only a handful of studies that address the impact of antidepressant exposure during CNS development. Nearly every study indicates the potential for a long-term negative impact. For example, transient inhibition of the serotonin transporter with fluoxetine during early development resulted in a major reduction in exploratory activity, as well as significant impairment in shock avoidance in adult mice. Other studies in rats have documented that early exposure to citalopram results in deficits in adult male sexual behavior and altered locomotor activity. Early exposure to citalopram was also found to cause profound reductions in cortical serotonin transporter expression and in a rate-limiting serotonin synthetic enzyme in the dorsal raphe. Both of these reductions persist into adulthood. More recently, LaRoche and Morgan reported that adolescent fluoxetine exposure produces enduring sex-specific alterations of visual discrimination and attention in male rats. John March and his Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Trials Network has just begun a prospective longitudinal study of newer antidepressants in over 2,400 children and adolescents with a depressive, anxiety, or eating disorder. The goals of this study are to identify factors that predict benefits and harms in the average patient, and also to identify patient-specific factors that predict who should always and who should never receive a particular medication. Fourth, the work by Melhem and colleagues in this issue of the journal has clear implications for prevention. Offspring of parents with mood disorders are at increased risk for suicidal behavior, especially in the presence of mood disorder and impulsive aggression in the offspring and a history of suicide attempt and sexual abuse in the parents. Hence, clinicians treating depressed adults should be aware of the need for careful follow-up and early intervention for their offspring. Conversely, those treating depressed adolescents must be alert for a history of parental depression and sexual abuse as markers for increased suicidal risk. Indeed, in studies of the familial aggregation of suicidal behavior, one factor that has been repeatedly identified is impulsive aggression. As has been emphasized in previous studies of adults, the management of impulsive aggression is likely to be critical in the prevention of suicidal behavior. In adults, psychosocial interventions that increase emotional regulation and decrease impulsive aggression are among the only interventions that have been shown to diminish the risk of reattempt. This concludes the highlights of the editorial by Lechman and King. Please refer to the September issue for the full editorial and for the Gibbons and Melhem articles. Next, we'll focus on an article addressing the relationship between depression and heart disease. The article is titled, "Non-Response to Treatment for Depression Following Myocardial Infarction, Association with Subsequent Cardiac Events." 70 depressed patients with a recent heart attack were treated with mirtazapine, and if that did not produce a result, they were switched to citalopram. At the end of 24 weeks, they were classified as responders or non-responders. The rate of cardiac-related death or hospitalization in the 18 months after the original heart attack was 26% for the non-responders, but only 7% among the responders. A genetic study is reported by Christian Ott and colleagues. The title is "Association of a Serotonin Transporter Polymorphism with Depression, Perceived Stress, and Norepinephrine in Patients with Coronary Disease, the Heart and Soul Study." The short allele of this genetic polymorphism is thought to reduce transcription efficiency for the 5-HTT gene, resulting in decreased serotonin transporter expression. The short allele appears to exert its effect in a dominant manner. The authors found that among more than 500 patients with coronary disease, 25% of those with one or two copies of the short allele for the serotonin promoter polymorphism had current depression. The rate of depression among the patients with two long alleles was 17%. Relative to the patients with long alleles, those with a short allele were 1.5 times as likely to have depression, moderate to high stress, and norepinephrine values in the highest quartile. The findings of the De Jonge and Ott studies are discussed in an editorial by Robert Carney and Kenneth Friedland titled "Depression and Coronary Heart Disease: More Pieces of the Puzzle." It has been nearly 20 years since major depression was identified as a risk factor for cardiac events in patients with stable coronary heart disease, and it has been nearly 15 years since depression was found to increase the risk of mortality after acute myocardial infarction. Because depression is treatable, these discoveries raised the hope that treating major depression would improve medical outcomes in the estimated 20% of patients with coronary heart disease who have this comorbid psychiatric disorder. However, Although many subsequent studies supported the initial findings, some did not. This has led to the conclusion that some, but not all, depressed patients are at high risk for cardiac events, and that the high-risk subset has not yet been identified. Recent meta-analyses support the status of depression as a risk factor for cardiovascular morbidity and mortality in patients with coronary heart disease. So far, however, only two clinical trials have been conducted to determine whether treating depression reduces the risk for cardiac events following a recent myocardial infarction. The first trial was named Enhancing Recovery in Coronary Heart Disease, or ENRICHED. The second was the Myocardial Infarction and Depression Intervention Trial, which is called MINDIT. Both interventions had only modest effects on depression, and neither of them improved survival. Most of the discussions about these studies have concluded that more effective treatments for depression in post-myocardial infarction patients are needed, and that more work is needed to identify the subset of depressed patients who are at highest risk for cardiac events. Two reports in this issue of the journal have brought us closer to reaching these goals. The report by DeYonge and colleagues is a secondary analysis of data from the MINDIT clinical trial. The patients who did not respond to depression treatment were at high risk for cardiac events during the follow-up. These findings are very similar to those recently reported in a secondary analysis of data from the ENRICH study. Moreover, nearly 60% of the non-responders were depressed 18 months after the index event, compared with fewer than 10% of the treatment responders. This suggests that patients who have persistent depression, despite treatment, may be at increased cardiac risk. Does this mean that patients who did not respond to the depression treatments in the ENRICHED and MINDIT studies were at high risk for cardiac events only because they remained depressed? Another possibility is that there may have been pre-existing differences between the responders and non-responders that placed them at high risk both for chronic depression and for cardiac events. However, there were few significant pre-treatment differences between the responders and non-responders in either trial. They did not differ in the severity of their medical illnesses, and there was no evidence of a relationship between treatment non-response and cardiac risk factors associated with vascular depression. In short, these studies have left few clues as to why the patients who remain depressed after treatment for depression are at high risk for future cardiac events, except that they remain depressed. However, the second study of depression and coronary heart disease may suggest another line of research for identifying high-risk patients, and perhaps even identifying more effective treatments for them. The study by Ott and colleagues adds to the growing evidence that the short allele for the serotonin promoter polymorphism may interact with stressful events, such as chronic medical illness, to increase the risk for becoming depressed. In an earlier study, Nakatani et al. Found that the short allele predicted depressive symptoms following an acute myocardial infarction. In addition, depression and the short allele also predicted subsequent cardiac events. The finding by Nakatani et al. Seems to be at variance with earlier studies that found the long allele to be a risk factor for incident myocardial infarction. However, the risk factors for incident myocardial infarction and those for cardiac events following a myocardial infarction are not identical. The risk for depression and the risk for cardiac events following an acute coronary syndrome may share a common genetic pathway. There is also some evidence that patients with the short allele may be less responsive to SSRIs or have more adverse events when receiving these agents compared to patients with the long allele. This relationship has been well documented in older adults, but a recent meta-analysis concluded that there is a highly significant association of the short allele with remission and response across all ages. Patients who did not respond adequately to either mirtazapine or placebo in the MINDIT study, and those who did not respond to cognitive behavior therapy in ENRICHED, were given an SSRI. Thus, many of the patients in both of these studies were classified according to their response to SSRIs following failure to respond to initial treatment. Whether the presence of the short allele of the serotonin transporter polymorphism identifies the depressed myocardial infarction patients who will not respond well to SSRIs and who are also at high risk for cardiac events remains for future studies to determine. However, further investigation of genetic factors, including the short allele, may prove to be fruitful in identifying depressed patients who are at high risk for cardiac events and for selecting the most effective depression treatments for these patients. This concludes our highlights from the editorial by Carney and Friedland. Please refer to the September issue for the complete editorial and the articles it discusses. Now we'll turn to a timely article by Megan Perrin and colleagues, Differences in PTSD Prevalence and Associated Risk Factors Among World Trade Center Disaster Rescue and Recovery Workers. The authors assessed post-traumatic stress disorder between September of 2003 and November of 2004. The participants were enrolled in the World Trade Center Health Registry, a longitudinal cohort of individuals highly exposed to the attack on September 11, 2001. Each of these people had worked at least one shift between September 11th and June of the following year. More than 28,000 people were assessed through half-hour computer-assisted telephone interviews. This group covered approximately one-third of the workers and volunteers eligible for the World Trade Center Health Registry. A diagnosis of probable PTSD was based on both the presence of the DSM-IV criteria and a score of 44 on the civilian version of the PTSD checklist. The rate of probable PTSD was calculated for each occupation separately. Police officers had the lowest rate, 6%. The highest rate, 21%, was for unaffiliated volunteers. The next highest rate was for construction and engineering personnel, 18%. The highest rates were found among workers who had performed tasks outside of their training. These included emergency, medical, and disaster personnel who engaged in firefighting and sanitation workers who performed search and rescue. Being injured increased the risk of PTSD for all workers, but witnessing trauma was not a risk factor for police, fire, and other emergency personnel. Risk was also higher for people who started working at the World Trade Center site on September 11th or immediately afterward, and for those who were injured. The probability of PTSD was also elevated for those who worked for more than 3 months, except among police. The relationship between time worked and the probability of PTSD was strongest for workers who started on September 11th, when the exposure to trauma and the risk of injury were greatest for all groups except police. Overall, the findings indicate substantial psychological distress years after the 2001 disaster, as well as differences in these reactions among the various types of workers who responded to the site. We'll conclude with two articles on aripiprazole, the first clinically available atypical antipsychotic drug that uses partial agonism at the dopamine D2 receptor to achieve an atypical antipsychotic profile. The first report is by Juchiol Chim and colleagues and is titled Adjunctive Treatment with a Dopamine Partial Agonist, Aripiprazole, for Antipsychotic-Induced Hyperprolactinemia, a Placebo-Controlled Trial. Hyperprolactinemia is a frequent and serious side effect of antipsychotic treatment. The introduction of second-generation antipsychotics has reduced the prevalence and severity of this condition, but it still commonly occurs in patients maintained with haloperidol and many other antipsychotic drugs. Outside the United States, haloperidol is commonly used as a first-line agent to treat psychosis. Moreover, some second-generation antipsychotic drugs also cause a marked and sustained increase in serum prolactin levels. Switching to a second-generation antipsychotic, such as olanzapine, quetiapine, or clozapine, can be effective in avoiding hyperprolactinemia. However, switching to these drugs is not always possible in clinical practice, especially if the patient has responded well to the antipsychotic that produced the hyperprolactinemia. Also, these antipsychotics may produce other adverse effects. Aripiprazole is a potent partial dopamine D2 agonist. It acts as a functional antagonist at the D2 receptors under hyperdopaminergic conditions, but it exhibits functional agonist properties under hypodopaminergic conditions. Aripiprazole monotherapy has little effect on prolactin levels and may actually lower them in people with prior antipsychotic exposure. Therefore, it may potentially offer benefits as an adjunctive treatment for secondary hyperprolactinemia. In this study, the participants were stable patients with schizophrenia who had received a constant dose of haloperidol for at least 3 months. Aripiprazole was administered at 15 milligrams per day for the first 4 weeks. Then it was increased to 30 milligrams for the following 4 weeks if it was clinically tolerated. 26 patients took aripiprazole and 28 took placebo. The baseline prolactin levels in the two groups were similar. Over the 8 weeks of the study, the levels fell significantly in the group receiving aripiprazole, but not in the group receiving placebo. At the end, 85% of the patients in the aripiprazole group had normal prolactin levels, compared to 4% in the placebo group. In addition, 2/3 of the women in the aripiprazole group who had menstrual disturbances at baseline regained menstruation by 8 weeks. The action of aripiprazole on D2 receptors and on serotonergic receptors was examined with positron emission tomography by David Mamo and colleagues. The results are reported in the article, Differential Effects of Aripiprazole on D2, 5-HT2, 5-HT1A Receptor Occupancy in Patients with Schizophrenia, a triple tracer PET study. In vitro studies have shown that aripiprazole acts as a partial agonist at D2 receptors and that it shows a lower affinity for 5-HT2 than D2 receptors. Preclinical work has also suggested antagonism at 5-HT2 receptors and partial agonism at 5-HT1A receptors. This study was designed to test these findings in patients treated with aripiprazole. Patients with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder were assigned to 4 doses of aripiprazole from 10 to 30 milligrams per day. Their previous antipsychotic medication was discontinued. After at least 2 weeks of treatment, the patients underwent PET scans to measure receptor occupancy. Very high occupancy was observed at D2 receptors in the striatum. Even the lowest dose of aripiprazole, 10 milligrams, produced 85% mean occupancy. At a daily dose of 30 milligrams, it was 91%. Occupancy was significantly correlated with plasma concentration. The percentages were lower for 5-HT2 receptors. The mean occupancy was 54% in the temporal cortex and 59% in the frontal cortex. It was even lower for the 5-HT1A receptors, 16% in the temporal cortex and 17% in the frontal cortex. These results argue against major roles for these receptors in aripiprazole's actions as an atypical antipsychotic. This concludes the audio highlights of the September issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. We invite you to refer to the online issue at ajp.psychiatryonline.org for the full text of these and other articles. Thank you.